Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's program, all about relics, with the current display of the Turin Shroud shining the spotlight on the issue of relics. We look at the history of relics within the church and examine some of the most popular and curious objects of veneration down through the ages. Haiti's uncertain future. It's nearly 4 months since Haiti's devastating earthquake that left over 1.5 million people homeless, and we find out more about the plight of the Haitian people and the daunting challenges they face to rebuild their future. And Vatican centuries. Hear about Bernini's work inside St. Peter's and how Galileo was condemned in the latest episode of our historical series that looks at the lives and legends of the people and places that went into the making of the Vatican over the ages. The current display of the Turin Shroud and Pope Benedict's visit this month to view the cloth has shone the spotlight on the issue of relics within the church and the various misconceptions surrounding them. The official definition of a relic is an object or body part that is venerated because of its association with a saint or a martyr. Contrary to what many people believe, the Catholic Church does not claim that relics have magic powers, but instead sees them as a way to come closer to a person who was deemed holy and thus form a closer bond with God. But why do relics fascinate Catholics and non-Catholics alike? And is the veneration of relics a macabre and ghoulish superstition, as many modern Christians claim? Well, to find the answers to those questions and explore the long and sometimes controversial history of relics within the church, I spoke to Liz Lev, an expert on Christian art and archaeology at Duquesne University's Rome campus.
Well, relics are a little bit of contact between something of this world and something of another world. I mean, technically, a relic is something that belonged to a saint. It is frequently a body part, which is often more surprising to some of our Anglo-Saxon listeners, but it is also things like a piece of clothing, something that belonged to a saint. And this object that remains long after the saint dies, that object becomes a connection, a physical, tangible reminder of the person's existence and the person's actual presence in heaven.
It is true, isn't it, that particularly perhaps in Anglo-Saxon cultures, there is a tendency to view relics as a rather ghoulish superstition, something rather macabre about it.
I dare say those two adjectives sum up how many, many Anglo-Saxon visitors view this interest in a body part, a hand in the Jesu, a body lying underneath the altar in St. Peter's. It seems to be something of a ghoulish fascination. Whereas for many, many, many years, ever since the remains of Polycarp were gathered up in the first century AD, these relics, these remains of saints, have been a precious part of the church tradition.
And they certainly fascinate and pull in the crowds. In this spring, we've seen over 1 million people travel to Turin to view the Turin Shroud. And amongst those pilgrims was Pope Benedict himself, of course, who's just been there. What does all this say?
Well, I think it's very interesting that Benedict himself, Benedict is the owner of the shroud as of 1983, when the former king of Italy gave the shroud, bequeathed the shroud to John Paul II. So even though it was in the hands of another person for many, many years, now the shroud actually belongs to the Pope. And the Pope decides when the shroud will be put on display, and Benedict XVI decided that for this period, the shroud would be put out extraordinarily for people to see. So despite this very sophisticated world that thinks that we seem to have answers for everything, this interest in something that connects us to supernatural seems to be very, very present and on the surface of people today.
And when it comes to the shroud, of course, many Christians see it as the ultimate relic, the thing closest to Christ, really the gospel in pictures. What's your view?
Oh, in a certain sense, this is the first witness of the body of Christ laid in the tomb. I mean, it was there when Christ was laid lifeless, and it was there when Christ resurrected. And this object that brings us to the central mystery of the Christian faith, what a fascinating and exciting thing to be near.
And another sign of this continuing massive interest in relics were the huge crowds that turned out in England and Wales in late 2009, when the relics of St. Thérèse of Lisieux, the little flower, toured around the country. I mean, this is not Christ. This is a 19th century sister who lived in obscurity for most of her life. And yet,
she always dreamed of being a missionary. And so her dream was, she died with tuberculosis at the age of 24, and St. Thérèse dreamed of being a missionary and going out into the world. Indeed, she is the patron of missions, and she did do her great missionary tour. She went everywhere. She's been all over the world besides to England and to UK. And in England, I believe, almost 300,000 people came to all of these different parishes, following her from Plymouth all the way up to London,
and this
increasing
is
in numbers. If you look at the numbers start out with a few thousand here, a few thousand here, then they move into the 10,000s. And it really grows and grows and grows as she travels.
And this was extraordinary when you consider that England is a highly secularized country where Catholics are only a small minority.
Exactly. It's even more surprising thinking that Catholics are a very small proportion of the population. And this is one of the countries that we consider amongst Europe as the spearhead of secularization. And yet comes this little flower, someone who's not famous heroine in the sense of action and adventure, but this deeply prayerful soul who was in close and intimate contact with Christ. And she comes in these a few bones in a casket, and she finds people following her from one end of the country to the other.
Now, you talked earlier about her desire to be a missionary, to go to all ends of the earth, and I gather that on the subject of her relics even went up in space. Did you know that one of the American astronauts took some relics around in space?
My goodness, that sounds like even on a spaceship, like, there are like relics seem to be side by side with the great discoveries.
Yes, indeed. And another case involving relics in recent years, of course, was when there was this huge interest among the faithful to get threads from one of the cassocks of the late Pope John Paul.
Well, John Paul II, who we are, of course, waiting for the announcement of his beatification. So already there's kind of the early game for the relics. Everybody wants to have something that one day will be classified as something that connects us to John Paul II in heaven.
And let's move on now to Padre Pio, a saint and another figure whose relics prove a real crowd puller, don't they? Can you give us some examples there? There was one in Rome a few years back.
Yes, there was one in Rome, and the crowds and the chaos, they brought it to a relatively small parish in the north of Rome, and the entire road was blocked. They had no idea that this many people would turn out. It was a Saturday or a Sunday afternoon when the Romans usually take off to the beach, and instead they went crowding around for a relic of Padre Pio. I have a little teeny relic of Padre Pio myself in my house, which is...
What's that?
It's a bit of a cassock, and it's very... It's amazing. It's amazing how people are always so... Oh, piece of Padre Pio.
Yes, and I mean, everywhere you go, you find devotion to Padre Pio, don't you? I mean, he really is one of these figures that cuts across.
I find the devotion to Padre Pio is one of the most beautiful unifiers of Italy. You get into a taxi cab and there's Padre Pio up against the visor. You go into a pizza store and there above, over to the corner of the cash register. You go everywhere, and if you look around long enough, you'll see someone, the little image of Padre Pio watching over the Italians. It's a beautiful, wonderful way of linking this people together through the grace of a saint.
Coming to the history, I mean, the veneration of relics is a very ancient practice within the church. Roughly, when did it begin, or how and when was it first mentioned?
Well, in the New Testament in particular, it's the remains of the martyrs that are the first fixation of the church. So the fact that...
Was it St. Polycarp?
It's St. Polycarp.
Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, Polycarp was martyred in about 155, and his body, albeit burnt and very little remaining, those pieces were gathered up together. And as they say, that these remains of Polycarp were more important or more treasured than those of precious stones. So we begin with the idea of keeping the bodies of the martyrs. However, in Rome, the idea of the breaking up of the relics the way that we do, we have a bit of a foot traveling around of Teresa, if my recollection is correct. That was not done in Rome. In Rome, what we had were the graves of the martyrs. And so generally the idea would be to celebrate Mass on the tomb where a martyr was buried. The exception to this, of course, is St. Peter and St. Paul, who are believed to have been moved from their original resting places because of the persecution, attack, possible danger, moved to another spot and then moved back, or simply moved into the hiding place where Peter's bones were ultimately found. But generally the idea, and Gregory the Great says so, he doesn't want to disturb the sleep of the martyrs. And so it's not really until the 8th century when this spate of Greek popes begins the movement of relics.
Or the dismemberment of the bodies.
The dismemberment of the bodies, yes.
Yeah. And what about the fragmentation of the true cross? I mean, do we have any idea at all how many fragments there are scattered across the globe?
Well, the Bollandists started a project in the 17th century, and it was to weigh and to measure all the pieces of the true cross that they could find. Apparently they aren't done yet. They're still working on it. But as yet, they haven't found enough to make up a single cross. The shards of the cross that are around are very, very small. And we do have a testimony that by 354, the cross had been found and fragmented already. And there's some testimonies to people who would wrap the wood of the cross in gold and wear it as necklaces. I mean, St. John Chrysostom tells us that he heard that by 354, the cross was already all over the empire.
Okay, coming to Rome, where do you consider the most fascinating collection of relics? Is it, in fact, in the Church of the Holy Cross in Jerusalem?
I think for pilgrims, the most meaningful relics in Rome are the relics of the Passion. They're so important, they're so...
Can you tell us exactly what they are?
They're so moving. You have these remains of elements of Christ's Passion. So you have a nail, two of the thorns from the crown of thorns. You have a piece of the true cross, of course. You have the headboard, and this is quite an important relic. It's the headboard that went over Christ's cross and believed to be authentic. Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews, written in three languages. And then apparently the crossboard of the cross of Dismas, which lies along the side. And of course, the relic of Thomas's finger, He Who Doubted, which is a very interesting thing to place in an arrangement of relics where people always ask, well, how do we know this? Is it real? Is it not real? So that's the great site for pilgrims to venerate relics. I believe even the pop star Madonna, not known for being overly interested in veneration of things Catholic, she herself went over there with her children not too long ago. However, the most famous collection of relics, however, was at St. John Lateran in what used to be in the Sancta Sanctorum. It was a collection of relics that was the personal collection of the Pope, and it was the greatest collection in the world. So important that it was written down in the 8th or 9th century in mosaic.
And what did it contain?
It had, besides the remains of St. Blaise and the various endless numbers of martyrs, but the relics collection still remains in St. John Lateran as pieces of the table of the Last Supper. We have the altar that Peter celebrated Mass on.
Now, when we come to relics, there's, of course, always, shall we say, the downside, the trade in false relics we've had right through the ages. What are some of the most glaring and wacky examples that you can think of that?
Oh, I seem to remember one of my favorites was the darkness from one of the plagues of Egypt. It was an all-time favorite of mine. There's a rumor around Rome that you have the foreskin of Christ somewhere. People became very adventurous in dreaming up things that they could produce as relics, but this was a relic mania that took place.
And of course, one of the rules, isn't it, that a relic should not be sold?
Cannot be sold. Cannot be sold.
Yes.
As a matter of fact, when the Council of Trent reiterates this in 1563, they say that no filthy lucre should be attached to it. And so relics are not not for sale. They're principally meant to be used in the consecration of a church. And this is from time immemorial, the use of a relic in the consecration of a church is, that's the proper place for it.
I was speaking to Liz Lev, an expert on Christian art and archaeology. It's nearly 4 months since the devastating earthquake that hit the island of Haiti, killing around 250,000 people and leaving 1.5 million others homeless. So how are the Haitian people coping with trying to rebuild their shattered lives in the wake of the huge humanitarian disaster triggered by January's earthquake? Even before the earthquake struck, Haiti was the poorest nation in the Western Hemisphere. Hundreds of thousands of those made homeless by the quake are currently living in makeshift tents, in precarious spontaneous settlements, making do with whatever aid arrives. Earthquake survivors have not only lost family members and their homes, but in many cases they have also lost their livelihood. So how is the morale of these people? And what is the future likely to bring them? For an answer, I turn to Nick Bredholt, a senior humanitarian officer at the London-based Catholic Development Agency, CAFOD. Nick has just returned from a 2-week visit to Haiti, and he told me more about the desperate plight of these earthquake survivors.
Well, I would say that the situation in general is quite dire, and this mainly because of the magnitude of the catastrophe, that so many people have been affected by this. We talk about more than 1 million people that have been made more or less homeless. And so even though that some camps are better run than other camps, I would say that in general, the situation is really still emergency.
And how would you describe the morale of the people when you got to speak to some of these people? How are they bearing up?
Well, there's a history of struggling for life in Haiti that goes a long way back. And the earthquake is just one more emergency, you can say. People, they are asking for all kind of help. When you come into the camps and you start speaking with people, they will ask you, why is there no more food distribution? We need support for schools. In Haiti, you pay school fees, even if it's public school, and people now have very limited income. And so they would say, you know, we need money also for schooling, and we need better services, we need better security. They'll actually ask for nearly everything, and it's quite, I would say, quite a challenge for everybody, for the NGOs, for the UN, and for the government structures in Haiti.
Now, of course, many say that the scale of the destruction and the high number of victims after the earthquake can be partly attributed to poor governance and living conditions, you know, the shoddy standard of the buildings, gross overcrowding in poor areas. Do you agree with that?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. The city has been built with low quality, low standards. Many of the buildings should never have been set up.
Some UN experts have, in fact, warned that the risk that the rebuilding could recreate these same living conditions, and therefore Haitians could run the risk of a similar scale catastrophe in the future. Do you think this is a real danger?
I think it is a real danger. I think that they should seriously consider decentralization in that country and move people out of Port-au-Prince, make Port-au-Prince a much smaller city than it used to be. Decentralization is not just good because of seismic activity in Port-au-Prince, but also just to get that country to function better. There is a real danger that there will be another earthquake, and there is a danger that the situation can repeat itself, yes.
What are some of the most impressive projects that have been done so far to aid or rehabilitate the victims, the homeless? Can you point to some of the success stories?
Well, I think we have to be modest here because of the magnitude. This is a very big city. There used to be something like 3 million people, and a huge part of that city was destroyed. And the fact that you have people now in camps and people are surviving and living, this is actually a success. Whereas I think it will take years before you will see real rebuilding, and particularly in the city.
Now, do you have any particular anecdotes that you can share with our listeners concerning either a particular individual or a family or a project that you came across, be it tragic or inspirational, that give us an idea of what Haitians are having to cope with right now?
Well, I did visit a number of camps and came across people who lost their children, people who are totally disillusioned and are just sitting in their tents, which is really tragic. I met a lady who was in a very cramped camp, and she had lost a child when her house had broken down, and she had some head injuries also from the crash of the house. She was really disillusioned. She used to have a small informal shop on the street just in front of her house, and this was not possible to run anymore, so she was really dependent on whatever help that could be given. It is really, really challenging times for the Haitian people. Another question is also, how long can the present situation go on without creating real unrest and perhaps violence in Haiti? There might be an issue of a silent honeymoon right now that can't go on forever, at least, because people do receive some help, people do receive some support for their life, and I would question whether that support is still possible to provide in 1.5, 2 years. And then what will happen then?
I was speaking to Nick Bredholt of the Catholic aid agency, CAFOD. We now broadcast the 37th episode in our ongoing historical series, where we look at the lives and legends of the people and places that went into the making of the Vatican. Today's episode is called A New Heaven, A New Earth, and tells us about Bernini's work inside St. Peter's and how the astronomer Galileo was condemned. The series is written and presented by Jill Bevilacqua and produced by Sean Patrick Lovett.
The 17th century was a time of intellectual and scientific development, of growing religious tolerance and a questioning of church authority, an age of kings when the very concept of kingship was challenged.
In England, conflict between monarch and parliament flamed into civil war and led to the execution of Charles I.
On the other side of the Channel, a child of five became king. Louis XIV, the Sun King, was to reign for 72 years.
In the New World, immigrants and explorers kept coming. In 1620, the Pilgrim Fathers had crossed the Atlantic in the Mayflower. In 1637, Russian pioneers reached the shores of the Pacific.
It was an era of practical discoveries and inventions. Logarithms, the barometer, the telescope, and even an adding machine.
William Harvey demonstrated the circulation of the blood. A Dutchman named Grotius set out the principles of international law.
René Descartes founded a new system of thought.
The early decades saw a flowering of metaphysical poetry, the appearance of the first opera, and movable scenery in the theatre.
Realism in painting, sculpture, and architecture was Balon's taste for grand, spectacular effects.
It was the beginning of Baroque, with Rome leading the way.
The new Basilica of St. Peter's was now a consecrated church, and, it might seem, a finished product. But there was splendor still to come. Genius was at work again, in the form of the newly appointed architect, Gian Lorenzo Bernini, the man who was to give St. Peter's Square the distinctive look it has today.
But it was on the interior of the church that the last great architect of St. Peter's was first employed. Urban VIII, the Barberini Pope, commissioned Bernini to design the canopy or baldacchino over the main altar.
The bronze of the canopy, which took over 10 years to make, is said to have been taken from beams in the portico of the Pantheon, and this produced a famous pasquinade, Quod non fecerunt barbari, fecerunt barberini. What the barbarians didn't do, the Barberini did.
Urban VIII was the pope who established the meticulous procedure to be followed for beatification and devotion to saints, a procedure which is still followed today. Urban also introduced the use of Your Eminence as a title for cardinals. In his government of the church, Urban brought his action into line with the Council of Trent, reformed the breviary, took an interest in church music, and gave more power to the Inquisition.
And here the Barberini Pope blotted his copybook for all time. For in 1633, he ordered proceedings to be taken against the Italian astronomer and mathematician, Galileo Galilei.
In the year 1581, a young man was watching a bronze lamp swinging in the Cathedral of Pisa. He noticed that whatever the range of its movements, they were always the same length. This was Galileo's first important discovery. He next found that the speed of falling bodies was the same whatever their weight, and to prove it, tossed two objects of differing weights from the top of the Leaning Tower of Pisa.
But it was with the telescope that Galileo was to make the most startling discoveries of all. In the autumn of 1609, he spent night after night stargazing, and when the English poet Milton visited him, he was able to recount that the Milky Way was powdered with stars. The moon had mountains and valleys, the sun had spots, and Jupiter had four satellites.
Galileo showed his telescope to the Doge of Venice, who stood on the top of the bell tower of St. Mark's and was delighted to be able to see ships 2 hours before their arrival in port.
In 1610, Galileo was in Rome with his telescope, showing the wonders of the skies to distinguished members of the papal court. His reception was so encouraging that he decided to publish his long-held belief in the Copernican system, even to the extent of trying to find scriptural confirmation for it.
This was Galileo's undoing. He was warned to confine reading to the physical sphere and to avoid theology. The Holy Office declared as heretical the proposition that the sun is immovable in the centre of the universe and that the earth moves round it. Galileo was instructed not to hold, teach, or defend the condemned doctrine. He agreed to obey. But 16 years later, he published his Dialogue on the Ptolemaic and Copernican Systems. It was hailed throughout Europe as a masterpiece of scientific exposition, but it was clearly in contradiction with the edict of 1616.
The scientist was summoned to Rome, and under threat of torture, compelled to abjure his theories. On his knees, he heard the sentence, imprisonment for life, and the weekly recital of the penitential psalms for 3 years. He was eventually allowed to leave Rome and spent the last 8 years of his life under house arrest in his villa in Arcetri. Cared for by his elder daughter and gradually growing blind, Galileo nevertheless continued his researches and writings to the end, which came on January 8, 1642.
Three centuries on, justice was finally done. On the 10th of November 1979, Pope John Paul II declared to the Pontifical Academy of Sciences that the Church is deeply indebted to Galileo, who had to suffer greatly through the fault of churchmen.
Another man of vision, the German mathematician and astronomer Johannes Kepler, wrote to his friend Galileo.
Give me the ships and adjust the sails to the heavenly winds. There will be those who will not fear for themselves, even when faced by that immensity. Yea, let us go, O Galileo, to prepare a new astronomy for those descendants of ours who in a very short time will be trying out this way.
The series was written and presented by Jill Bevilacqua and produced by Sean Patrick Lovett. Well, that's all for today. Thanks for listening. I'm Susie Hodges. We'll be on the air again at the same time tomorrow, and you can check out our website at any time on www.vaticanradio.org. Laudato Jesus Christus.